Peter B. Collins News and Comment. Viewers on Facebook, just watch me put on the headphones and put Chloe on the floor so that we can begin our live Facebook video feed and the News and Comment podcast today. As usual, I'll be taking your phone calls, and if you want to jot down the number, you're welcome to call in at any time, and we will chat about the news that I'm covering today. My number, I wanted to say toll-free, but this one is, you got to pay for the freight. It's 415-455-0102, 415-455-0102. I'd love to hear your comments, particularly about Trump's itch for war with North Korea. But we begin today in Silicon Valley, about 40 miles south of my secret studio location, where the Googlers are searching for the balance between free speech and diversity. And just before I sat down here, I entered in a Google search window the terms free speech and diversity at Google. And it produced an interesting result from the National Review called The Corner. And the headline reads, "We support free speech, but..." And I want to open up a little challenge here to you who are listening and viewing, and to others who may hear about this later. And that is, I encourage you to follow the link in the show file for today's podcast and actually read James Damore's statement. I'm going to get to that and read you some quotes from it in just a moment. But yesterday, Google had scheduled a town hall meeting on the Google campus in Mountain View, and it was canceled after several employees became concerned about a Gamergate style of a campaign of harassment by internet trolls angered by the firing of James Damore earlier in the week. The CEO, Sundar Pichai, wrote an email to the Googlers saying, "We had hoped to have a frank, open discussion today, as we always do, to bring us together and move forward. But following the leak of proposed discussion questions," he said, "Googlers were being personally named on websites. Googlers are writing in," he said, "concerned about their safety and worried that they may be outed publicly for asking a question in the town hall." Now, all this started last weekend when James Damore posted a 20-page memo, circulated it, I believe, among any interested parties on the Google headquarters campus in Mountain View. And it produced a strong reaction, and almost within 24 hours, Damore was fired, saying that he was promoting stereotypes in his memo. And this has led to a backlash where members of the self-styled alt-right believe that a fellow conservative is being silenced unfairly for comments that were not politically correct. And there's been a strong reaction from the promoters of diversity who believe that he did cross a line and deserve to be terminated. But here it is, James Damore's diversity memo. And again, I invite you, and if I need to, I challenge you to click on the link and read this for yourselves. Because while I don't agree with everything he says, I think he was extremely polite. I think that he was trying to be fair and balanced. I know it's bad to use those two words in the same phrase. You think I'm a fox nut, right? But he wrote some comments after the backlash visited him. He said, "I value diversity and inclusion. Am not denying that sexism exists. Don't endorse using stereotypes. When addressing the gap in representation in the population, we need to look at population-level differences in distributions." Now, keep in mind, this is a pretty smart guy. He's got multiple degrees. He's a talented engineer. And I think that it's interesting to look into his worldview and his mindset. He said, "If we can't have an honest discussion about this, we can never truly solve the problem. Psychological safety is built on mutual respect and acceptance, but unfortunately, our culture of shaming and misrepresentation is disrespectful and unaccepting of anyone outside its echo chamber." All right? So, in the memo, and I'm just going to highlight a few things here. Obviously, I'm not going to read 20 pages to you. You'd click off. He writes, differences in distributions of traits between men and women may in part explain why we don't have 50% representation of women in tech and leadership. Discrimination to reach equal representation is unfair, divisive, and bad for business. At Google, we talk so much about unconscious bias as it applies to race and gender, but we rarely discuss our moral biases. Political orientation is actually a result of deep moral preferences and thus biases, considering that the overwhelming majority of the social sciences, media, and Google lean left. We should critically examine these prejudices. Now he defines himself. I consider myself a classic liberal and strongly value individualism and reason. I'd be very happy to discuss any of the document further and provide more citations. Neither side is 100% correct, and both viewpoints are necessary for a functioning society, or in this case, a company. Only facts and reason can shed light on these biases, but when it comes to diversity and inclusion, Google's left bias has created a politically correct monoculture that maintains its hold by shaming dissenters into silence. This silence removes any checks against encroaching extremist and authoritarian policies. Then he has a list of bullet points here. On average, men and women biologically differ in many ways. These differences aren't just socially constructed. And he lays them out. And whether you agree or disagree, this is not a hateful memo. He does not display any misogyny in my humble and male perspective. And one of the most, one of the lines that has produced quite a bit of reaction is this bullet point. Women, on average, are more prone to anxiety. Now, you can disagree with that. But he doesn't use that argument to try to belittle women, to say that they don't belong at Google, they don't belong in engineering. And a little later, he says, in an area that's headed the harm of Google's biases, I strongly believe in gender and racial diversity. I think we should strive for more. However, to achieve a more equal gender and race representation, Google has created several discriminatory practices. Programs, mentoring, and classes only for people with a certain gender or race. A high priority queue and special treatment for diversity candidates. Hiring practices which can effectively lower the bar for diversity candidates by decreasing the false negative rate. These practices are based on false assumptions generated by our biases and can actually increase race and gender tensions. We're told by senior leadership that what we're doing is both the morally and economically correct thing to do, but without evidence, this is just veiled left ideology that can irreparably harm Google. Then he goes into suggestions. He says, I hope it's clear I'm not saying that diversity is bad, that Google or society is 100% fair, that we shouldn't try to correct for existing biases, or that minorities have the same experience of those in the majority. My larger point is that we have an intolerance for ideas and evidence that don't fit a certain ideology. I'm also not saying we should restrict people to certain gender roles. I'm advocating for quite the opposite. Treat people as individuals, not just as another member of the group, parentheses, tribalism. So I could not find anything that was truly incendiary, inflammatory, or that would warrant the dismissal of James Damore. And as you know, I'm pretty extreme on the First Amendment. Yes, I believe that Milo Yiannopoulos should have been allowed to speak at UC Berkeley. And I am drawn to agree with David Brooks, the conservative-leaning, he's not a Trumpist, op-ed columnist at the New York Times. And he says, after making a pretty detailed case here, that it's Google's CEO, Pichai, who should be fired. He said, this brings us to Pichai, the supposed grown-up in the room. He could have wrestled with the tension between population-level research and individual experience. He could have stood up for the free flow of information. Instead, he joined the mob. He fired Damore and wrote to suggest a group of our colleagues have traits that make them less biologically suited to that work is offensive and not okay. So, I'd like to hear your comments on this. And my phone lines are open right now. You can call in, and I'll pause the news and comment here to take your call. 415-455-0102. I've got four lines available. You can call in right now and express yourself. You can agree or disagree with me. I think this is a very interesting issue, and it is worthy of a greater discussion. I also want to note that there are two must-read articles this week. One came to me in a Facebook link earlier today, and it's written by a woman I've had no awareness of before, Brianna Joy Gray. It appears in Current Affairs online at currentaffairs.org. I have linked to it in the show file for the podcast, so you can take a look. And I think this woman is brilliant. She takes on the issues of identity politics and the use of identity politics as a weapon against people who don't conform to the norm of a particular group. She starts by talking about California's new senator, Kamala Harris, who is of Jamaican and Indian, not Native American, Indian heritage. And because she is a woman of color, people project a lot of things on Kamala Harris. And lately, progressives have politely expressed some of their disagreements with Kamala Harris. The pushback then comes that you are racist, that you are anti-woman, that you are trying to impose your progressive worldview on this individual. And I really encourage you to read this piece. I think it's a fascinating look at the identity politics that drove the 2016 campaign. And in particular, she focuses on people of color, for example, who supported Bernie Sanders and who were dismissed as part of the Bernie bros. Even women of color were lumped together with Bernie bros. And there are fair criticisms of Kamala Harris. She was the attorney general here in California and failed to crack down on IndyMac, the bank run by Steven Mnuchin, who's now, Secretary of the Treasury. Mnuchin made a contribution. The only Democrat he supported in 2016 was Kamala Harris. And so there are legitimate policy differences. And I exercised a similar process last year about Hillary Clinton. And I was called a sexist and a misogynist because I honestly told you I couldn't support Hillary Clinton because of her hawkish policies, because of her track record as a senator and as the Secretary of State. I lost a lot of female subscribers and listeners, and I was, called a misogynist in comments that were posted online. And the Sanders campaign, where there was a strong component of African Americans and African American women who rejected Hillary Clinton in favor of the progressive policies of the white guy from Vermont. And so I really encourage you to read that piece, and I'd like to hear your reactions to it. I've got a caller on the line. Who's this? Welcome to the Peter B. Collins podcast.
Yes, Peter B., Jason Spitzer in San Jose. How are you?
Hi, Jason. Great to hear from you. Right there in Silicon Valley.
That's right. And so not too far from Google, actually. I'm actually at work, but I was taking some time out to listen to the show.
Thank you.
I just had a quick question regarding this firing at Google, and I agree with you. I agree with David Brooks. I think Google wimped out. I think their management wimped out.
Mm-hmm.
It was a teachable moment when they could, have an internal discussion about this issue. And I agree that the memo was quite civilized, and I think he had some bias there. I also don't agree with everything in it. But
wait a minute, Jason. Are you saying you've actually read this memo?
I did read the memo, yes.
Because I want to echo Connor Friedersdorf, who writes at The Atlantic, who said that never have so many people made off-base comments about a document that is widely available. And all you got to do is take a few minutes to read it. But we've seen a lot of people, and it's this kind of Facebook reaction, where you see a headline and you just say, oh, I don't like that. Or you see a headline that is pandering to you, you say you like it, but you never actually click and read the article that underlies it.
Right. Yeah, I'm not completely without sin in that regard, but I do try to read what I form an opinion about first.
Mm-hmm.
you know, here's the thing, though, is he did it at work, you know, and it's on company time. It was circulated within the company. That's my understanding anyway. It puts Google's management on a spot. You know, had he done this outside of work, had he had posted this on his own blog or something like that, and, you know, had Google gone after him after doing that, you know, I'd call that clearly and wrong. And there are a lot of corporations that would go after somebody publishing something on their own time. You know, California is an at-will employment state. They can basically get rid of you for any reason they want to, and the employee has a little recourse. Unless you can prove age or gender or some other, you know, discrimination, you don't have any recourse at all.
However, Jason, I want to chew on your argument here a little bit, because so far, no one at Google has said that he was fired because he did this on company time or used company facilities. And I would argue that because this was about Google, and that they, at least for public relations purposes, pose as being open to dialogue. And, you know, you can go to these meetings and talk to Sergey or Larry. So I really don't see that as a pivotal point.
Yeah, I guess I work for other companies. You know, I work I've worked for corporate America my entire career, and I just know at most companies, you know, you got to check it at the door a little bit. You know, I have to check my politics at the door. I know I'm going to get in trouble if I spout off.
Yeah, I get your point.
You know, and I know Google is to their credit, they're much more enlightened and welcoming to diverse viewpoints than many other companies. You know, they have politicians and thinkers and intellectuals and luminaries come in and give lectures at Google.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they seem to, on one hand, encourage free thought and open discussion, but on the other hand, they're just a corporation that's reporting to shareholders. You know, and I know what they stand for publicly, but privately, you know, behind the scenes, they're just a corporation.
Yeah, well, and there, I'm not going to go into depth here, but I'll just tick off a couple of points, because the Google story is very complicated. They're knee deep with the surveillance state. They are rivals of the NSA in collecting personal information on virtually every American. They use it commercially. The NSA stores it to, presumably use against you at some critical point in the future. The fact that they have the only access to the Moffett Field airport there, and they're allowed to fly their corporate jet in and out of there, certainly bugs the shit out of Larry Ellison at Oracle. But I think it's an example of the very tight relationship that they enjoy with the spook divisions of our government. And I'm looking forward to the publication of Yasha Levine's book in a few months called Surveillance Valley, because he and I have had a lot of great conversations about the dark side of Google. So I won't go any further on that today. But, Jason, I really appreciate your call. John in Sacramento says he agrees with my comments. And if you don't agree with my comments, I'd like to hear from you. 415-455-0102 is the number. 415-455-0102. Now, the other must-read article this week was published in The Nation under the byline of Patrick Lawrence, and I highlighted this yesterday. And let me just read the headline. A new report raises big questions about last year's DNC hack. Former NSA experts say it wasn't a hack at all, but a leak, an inside job with someone with access to the DNC system. Now, I consider this to be a pivotal point in the promotion of the so-called Trump-Russia narrative. As you know, I've been skeptical about this idea that it was an outside hack, and specifically a Russian hack, because my colleague, my interview source, Bill Binney, the former technical director of the NSA, who is a major player in this Nation article, he's the one who told me that the systems were in place and the NSA could have identified hacking activity, but not leaking activity. And the forensic information that has recently surfaced, that has been augmented by the work of Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, Bill Binney's a member of that group, along with Ray McGovern and many others. They, I think, are really cracking the hold that the Trump-Russia narrative, which, again, has no public evidence to support it. It's based entirely on anonymous leaks, and it's been a ping-pong game between the corporate television outlets and the New York Times and the Washington Post to see who can anonymously leak the biggest story about Trump and Russia. And as you know, I await evidence for that, but there is actually some evidence to support the notion of the insider leak. So I encourage you to read this important article in The Nation. And one of the things that tickled me is when I got in the car this morning and turned on my AM radio, Rush Limbaugh was in the middle of a rant about the report from veteran intelligence professionals for sanity and the leak versus hack argument. Now, that plays to Russia's bias. He wants to defend Trump. But I am waiting for the day when Ray McGovern and or Bill Binney are invited as guests on Rachel Maddow's show, and she gives them that whole A block, the 21-minute segment at the top of the show, so that they can have a polite discussion about the differences between their arguments about the leak and Rachel's assertions, without evidence, that are now treated as fact, that it was a Russian hack. So I sent an email to Ray McGovern. I said, "Hey, Ray, I dropped in on Rush Limbaugh about 45 minutes into his second hour today. He was talking about the VIPS report on the DNC leak, painting the group, your group, as a far-left forensic group founded by Ray McGovern, and Rush called him a cross-dressing street preacher." I'll continue to quote from my email to Ray. He said the last time we'd heard from VIPS was during the Valerie Plame case. That's not true. And he added something about how VIPS is a group of Putin lovers. And I told him, you might want to find a recording, catch the whole sequence, and maybe you can threaten a libel suit or demand a correction. And I said, in any case, the tide is turning in the debate over leak versus hack. And to reprise what I just said, the tipping point will be when you're invited on Rachel Maddow to offer arguments and evidence for the leak scenario. And Ray did reply. He said that he was kind of, you know, pleased that Limbaugh's paying attention. And while he's not a cross-dresser, he does acknowledge that he's kind of a shabby dresser. I also want to note on the same subject that we have a very smart listener in Switzerland, Olivier. And he said, "Peter, although I would also guess, just like you, that the DNC data was moved out by an insider, I think you should mention the analogy between leaving Cyrillic words in a file and leaving certain timestamps in a file." He says, "These traces can be interpreted as being clues to the identity of the data thief, and they also can be manufactured intentionally in order to sidetrack such an identification." Now, I agree that the timestamp thing is more probably legitimate, but strictly speaking, this all lives on a spectrum of possible fakeries. I think you should mention that possibility, even if it is small, just like you mentioned that the Cyrillic traces are possibly fakes. You can ask Bill Binney, is it possible to fake these timestamps? The answer, in Olivier's opinion, is yes, and I think he has a point there. And I don't consider the forensic work that has been done so far to be conclusive. I think it is directive. I think it directs our investigation. And what's fascinating about this article in The Nation is that Patrick Lawrence never mentioned Seth Rich once. Now, is that a calculation on his part to avoid being pilloried by people claiming it's a conspiracy theory? Or is that simply because the evidence didn't lead him in that direction? But to me, the unexplored angles that have been left to get cold by all of the preoccupation with Russia as the lead suspect are Seth Rich, who had the means to conduct this, and if we can believe Seymour Hersh, there is information that the FBI has from Seth Rich's computer that showed that at minimum he contacted WikiLeaks and sent them some samples. Secondly, we have the case of the House IT consultant Imran Awan, who was working for Debbie Wasserman Schultz, had access to her iPad that she used for all of her DNC activities. He is a likely suspect, in my view, as well. And yet the corporate media, I laugh when I flip on Rachel Maddow's show at night And I just ask myself, how long will it be before she mentions Russia? And it's usually about 15 seconds. Now, one of the upshots of the whole wrangling over the 2016 election, if you're a regular listener or viewer on Facebook, you know that I believe the election was manipulated and rigged, and that Hillary Clinton actually won despite my lack of support for Mrs. Clinton. And it was rigged by the interstate cross-check list, by the photo ID laws in a number of red states, and by a lot of other activities by the Republicans, including the Trump campaign's use of Cambridge Analytica, which often goes less noticed. But because Trump claims that he actually won the popular vote as well as the Electoral College, he formed this fake voter fraud commission. Now, you and I know there wasn't any major voter fraud, and it certainly didn't rise to the level of flipping the outcome of the election. But we got Kris Kobach, who ran the interstate cross-check list as Secretary of State of Kansas. He's running for governor there. He's running this commission. Mike Pence is nominally the head, but Kobach is in charge. And as the AP points out this week, the Voter Fraud Commission could take away the one level of security we have, and that is that our voter files and voting systems are decentralized. They're not only different in each of the 50 states, they're different in different counties in those 50 states. And while this is a deficit in certain ways, it's also a security buffer, because you got to hack all 50 states, and some states have almost 200 counties. But if the states respond affirmatively, and most have rejected the call from the Kobach Commission to share all of their voter files with this national task force, well, then the list would be just in one place for easy access by hackers of any kind. If you're on Facebook right now, please share the video feed that we're running from Peter B. Collins' page, and pick up the phone and give me a call, because I'm about to discuss the Trump tweets toward North Korea, and that is topic A today. I want to hear your comments about the reckless manner in which Donald Trump is risking war. And this is all over bully tactics and trading threats with the 33-year-old Kim Jong-un. And it's really distressing that we're now in day three of Trump's escalating threats toward North Korea. Today, his tweet early this morning, military solutions are now fully in place, locked and loaded, should North Korea act unwisely. Hopefully, Kim Jong-un will find another path. This is so dangerous. And by giving the world stage to Kim Jong-un, by putting North Korea on equal footing with the United States, and by engaging in these adolescent-level threats, where Trump's bluff has been called. And we heard the general from North Korea yesterday explicitly threaten to launch missiles that would come within a couple of miles of Guam, and he said he'd be ready in mid-August, awaiting orders from his dear leader. Now, that's a very explicit threat. And Trump now has to figure out, okay, if he does that or something like that, what am I going to do about it? Because I have threatened fire and fury and power and actions that the world has never seen before. And yesterday I noted that he has moved from what diplomats call constructive ambiguity to a very destructive form of ambiguity that could force him to act over some minor provocation that is placed out there by Kim Jong-il and North Korea. And we could end up in a huge conflict with thousands of people dying, even without a nuclear exchange. This shows his inexperience, his personal insecurity, and it places us all, Not just Americans, at very grave risk. And despite the tensions, the U.S. and South Korea say that they intend to go ahead with the annual sea, land, and air exercises, the war games that we conduct on an annual basis. These are going to happen in the around the 21st of August. It'll be in the region. And I believe that if we had a reasonable president, he would launch negotiations based on suspending these war games. And Trump, who, you know, presents himself as the greatest deal maker in the world, doesn't have the nuance and the ability to pick up on an opportunity like this. And this is just one example where diplomacy could reduce the tensions and avoid a looming conflict. And so this is a very tense summer. In China, according to the New York Times, they're dismissive of Trump's threats. And they have a term called Keopu, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, which means reliable. And they describe Trump as Bu Kaopu, which means unreliable. His statement this week about North Korea was something that only deepened that perception in China, according to analysts. Quote, the Chinese don't like North Korea's nuclear program, but the current situation does serve their longer-term interests in eroding American leadership because it provides a whole new set of circumstances in which America shows its weakness. That's a comment from Australia's former senior defense strategist, Hugh White. Now, White went on to say that too often the U.S., and this is his perception, the U.S. has declared it would use force, like to stop China's expansion in the Spratly Islands, like the so-called red line about chemical weapons that Obama drew in Syria, and that when we make threats and then don't act, we do seriously undermine our credibility for future confrontations. So I'd like to hear your comments about this. My lines are open for you right now at 415-455-0102. 415-455-0102. This is why I do the Facebook Live video feed. I don't think people are that excited about seeing my talking head at the secret studio. But this is a way that we can go live. It's accessible everywhere in the world where Facebook is, and to almost every device. So I encourage you to express yourself. This is your opportunity to comment on the issues that are before us right now, and I'd like to hear from you at 415-455-0102. Oh, and Marco says he likes my fancy graphics. Yeah, thanks. Trump has been on a media binge. You know, he hasn't held a formal news conference, I think, since February. But at his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey, he called in the media and then he wouldn't stop talking. And Sarah Sanders, his press secretary, kept holding up a sign that said, last question. But he kept going. He continues to attack Mitch McConnell, his nominal Republican ally and leader of the Republican majority in the Senate. And I can only say that when Republicans are fighting, it puts a smile on my face. Trump, in an attempt at humor or irony, when asked his reaction to Vladimir Putin's decision to eject a bunch of Americans from the U.S. embassy in Moscow, and to also to force out a whole bunch of Russians who worked there as employees of the United States. And so instead of threatening to take other efforts to sanction Russia, Trump kind of surprised people. He said, well, I want to thank Putin because we're trying to cut down on payroll. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm very thankful that he let go a large number of people because now we have a smaller payroll. Well, that's an interesting dodge, actually. And he also told reporters that he hasn't given any thought to firing Bob Mueller as the special counsel. That's just fake news from the media in this country. Now, it's interesting to see, as I have been reporting to you here on the podcast, that the U.S. media aligns with the government in presenting only negative reporting about Venezuela and the Maduro government. because it's socialist, because it is the successor to Hugo Chavez, the U.S. Just has a blind spot here. And by imposing these sanctions and alienating Venezuela further, we've just created a new opening for Moscow. And Putin is described as conducting negotiations to help bail out the Venezuelan economy by buying oil from the state-owned oil company PDVSA. And this is really the long arc of American bad foreign policy in our own hemisphere. It started with Cuba, where we decided that by freezing out Cuba, we would teach them a lesson. Well, all it did was thrust them into the arms of Moscow and to, you know, a minor extent, to China. And they went on to build their own kind of socialist slash communist axis around the world. And so we believe that we're so cool and we're so powerful and we're so right that we can impose our ideas on other nations. And this is a stunning example of how that backfires. Even Republican senators are urging Trump not to extend sanctions to the oil sector because it would hurt both American crude refiners and force Venezuela to default on its debts, handing over oil assets to Russia, who holds the collateral on a lot of their heavy industry infrastructure in Venezuela. Israel has announced that it is building a new wall around Gaza, the open-air prison where millions of Palestinians are trapped. This new wall will be below ground. They're planning to go like 150 feet down. It's going to cost over $1 billion. And they believe that by building this new barrier, it will prevent tunnels from Gaza into Israel. And anybody with half a brain knows that you can tunnel into the earth as far as you really want to. And that if Israel puts a 150-foot barrier in, Palestinians will dig a tunnel that's 160 feet down. And I remind Israel of the Maginot Line. It was constructed on the border of France and Germany after World War I. It was a series of heavy artillery facilities, but the French made a huge mistake. The rotation on the artillery was not 360 degrees. I think it was less than 270. And when the Luftwaffe overflew the Maginot Line and then came in from behind, the Maginot Line cratered almost immediately. There's a lot of excitement in Wisconsin because Foxconn, the manufacturer and assembler of a lot of computer components, including all of my Apple toys, they have pledged to spend billions of dollars and build a huge factory in southeast Wisconsin, described as a high-tech campus the size of 11 professional football stadiums. They're promising to hire 13,000 people. But in Wisconsin, which is now a Republican machine state run by Scott Walker and the Koch brothers, they have offered subsidies to Foxconn that will cost the state $19,000 per job created every year. And a financial neutral analyst predicted that it would take taxpayers until 2043 to recoup the losses from the special deals that are being offered to Foxconn. And we're told that even the Republican leader of the lower house, Scott Fitzgerald, oh no, he's the leader of the state Senate, the upper house, my apology, he said he doesn't know if he has the votes to approve this deal in its current form. And I would submit that Foxconn is highly unreliable. They have dangled the prospect of American manufacturing facilities in multiple locations on multiple occasions. And this is just the latest. Will Foxconn actually follow through and build a single factory and hire a single employee in Wisconsin? I think that's a fair and open question. If you're watching on Facebook, this is the Peter B. Collins podcast live video feed. I've got lines open if you'd like to comment. It's just like talk radio. You can call in. You can talk to me. You can argue with me. It's always more fun when people disagree. You've heard me talk about a range of topics here today, and I invite your reaction. 415-455-0102 is my number. And this is the last Facebook Live for the next few weeks. I'm going to take some vacation. I'll be back at the end of August or early September. I haven't really firmed up all those plans. But if you've got something to say, this is the moment to share it with our listeners. Now, this week I did two very interesting in-depth interviews that I invite you to listen to when you have an opportunity. One is with Teresa Beasley, and she served for 10 years as a sexual assault response and prevention counselor at the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. And she is in the process of being drummed out of her job after facing retaliation for two key incidents. One was a case where a counselor in another office propositioned. He made a pass at a female cadet who was there to get counseling for a sexual assault that she had reported. That male counselor still works at the Air Force Academy, but Teresa Beasley is being terminated. She also resisted efforts to shave the reports of the number of sexual assaults compiled at the Air Force Academy in the academic year of 2014-15. And she went through channels. But despite being offered confidentiality by the Pentagon's Inspector General, her confidential reports were shared, and it left her vulnerable to further retaliation. I asked Teresa Beasley about the climate in Colorado Springs, which is a hotbed of evangelical Christianity. It's where Focus is in the Family is headquartered. And how the forces of evangelicalism meet the testosterone of the Air Force Academy and what it means for the quarter of the population there that is female. Here's an excerpt from my in-depth interview with whistleblower Teresa Beasley.
The VA has a, you know, a 65, 70 bill.
Excuse me, that was the wrong clip. I've got it right here. And let's try this again.
The joke here is there's a church on every corner, and there is that pervasive Christian throughout the Colorado Springs community, of course. But in terms of the academy, that attitude kind of shines through with cadets are not allowed to have sex in the dorms, and it's considered a presumptive disenrollment when they are caught or if they admit to having sex in the dorms. So, and we also, it's kind of verboten to even really talk openly about sex, even healthy sex, with cadets at the academy. It's a very conservative climate. We've kind of found this out that the only time we talk to cadets about sex is about sexual assault. That's and even that is frowned upon. It's back in the Jurassic era almost when it comes to talking about intimate behavior. And if we can't talk openly about any kind of sex at all, it's just not a very healthy climate, and it's certainly a conservative one. I myself have gotten into trouble for using some of the terminology that we use to discuss sexuality and sexual assault. I've had a few people talk to me about that. And the way young people talk about sex these days is pretty frank and sometimes bordering on vulgar, you know. But I've been very unpopular with some of the terminology I've used and been called out on it a lot. So it's not only that we don't talk openly about sexual assault, that's not very popular. We don't talk about any sex at all, and the cadets are not really they're not permitted to have sex at all.
So abstinence is a central component of the code of conduct, and yet in this high testosterone environment where the religiosity prevents open discussion of, you know, the natural elements of human sexuality, that repression can lead to sexual harassment and sexual assault at a level that would be greater than in the general population. Is that your perception?
I think that's a big part of it, yes. It's just we don't admit it's going on. We don't even want to acknowledge it's going on.
That's Teresa Beasley, and I'm really impressed with her courage blowing the whistle. And she even spoke honestly about how the first female superintendent of the Air Force Academy is apparently complicit in pushing out Teresa Beasley from her job there. I invite you to listen to the full interview. It's available for my subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, at iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spreaker, and many other outlets where you can find my podcast. Got a caller on the line here. Who's this?
Hi, it's Kyle here in Topanga, your regular caller.
Hey, Kyle. Welcome back. Good to talk to you.
Thank you, and likewise. I'm afraid I missed the first 40 minutes. I was impressed by your whistleblower there. She was spot on, of course, about the endemic sexism and rampant mania that goes on in our armed forces. I'm interested, though, in knowing if you talked about the North Korea craziness. I'm sure you did.
Yes, we did.
And it's gotten to the point where I was thinking about paying my rent today, and I suddenly realized I should check the news first to see if we're on the edge of World War III.
Well, you know, there is a gallows humor, and, you know, I think people in Guam and Hawaii are feeling it probably a little more intently than people in California. But let's be real, Kyle. Okay, you know, Kim Jong-un is a young thug, a punk, who is, you know, eager for world attention. And Trump has given it to him. He's elevated North Korea to the level of the United States on the world stage. And by trading threats with this guy and having his bluff called with this explicit threat to attack Guam, or at least to launch missiles close to Guam that would fly over Japan, it's put the U.S. in a bind, and Trump now has to figure out how he may make good on these threats. I also mentioned that the U.S. is intent on carrying through the scheduled war games with South Korea that will start around the 21st of August. Now, the general from North Korea who made the threat about Guam said that he'll be ready by the 15th, and he's just waiting for orders from the dear leader. What I posited is that if Trump were a different person, and I'll say, you know, I objected to Hillary Clinton's hawkishness, and it's a big reason why I couldn't have supported her last year. But if she were in office right now, I think she is nimble enough to say, you know, we could delay these war games as a chit to begin some sort of talks or negotiations with North Korea. And I'd get Dennis Rodman on a plane tomorrow. Maybe with an adult like Bill Richardson, the former New Mexico governor and UN ambassador who has negotiated with North Korea in the past. And, you know, I would begin some initiatives. But Trump is only, you know, a reactive guy who thinks about his own ego, his own insecurities, and how he's got to talk like he's 10 feet tall. And this is a recipe for big disaster, Kyle.
Well, absolutely. I'm wondering, and I just put this thought out there to see if it can resonate out any further. If the rest of the whole world, which of course has a very big stake in all of this, if the rest of the world isn't willing to at some point say to the United States, and I suppose to North Korea as well, guys, you have to stop now, you know, and make it clear that by whatever means necessary, and I'm talking about the entire rest of the world, that they actually unite to say, okay, you want sanctions, you're going to get sanctions. And
well,
we're talking serious
action. But Kyle, here is where Trump repeatedly pisses on himself. All right?
Yeah.
Because he actually achieved something, okay? He and Nikki Haley, the philandering, or at least former philandering governor of North Carolina.
Yeah, now we're back to that again. Funny how that comes around.
She got the Security Council 15-0 to pass this new package of sanctions. I'm not a big fan of sanctions, but it is it's a meaningful, iconic statement that China did not abstain or veto that resolution. And instead of allowing that to work its course, whatever it might be, Trump is responding to, a couple of taunts from Kim Jong-il. Jong-un. Sorry, I got my ill and my un mixed up.
It's easy to do.
Yeah, it is.
Well, so here we are at the end of the world or something. I personally don't believe that we're going to get nuked, and that's why I'm going to go down and pay my rent. So we'll end on a positive note.
Good, Kyle.
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you for the call. I do appreciate it. And by the way, I see on my Facebook page that Barry Lynn may still be watching. Barry, if you're watching right now, would you call in? I'd like to talk to you. Here's the number, 415-455-0102. Barry Lynn is about to retire as the executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. And he is a great guy who I've known for a long time. I'm tickled that he's connected up on Facebook today. And Barry, if you're still there, call in. I'd love to talk to you. Now, in Texas, very interesting developments as the right-wing conservative Republican legislature and Governor Greg Abbott are chomping at the bit for their own transgender bathroom bill. And what we're seeing is that while liberals don't matter in Texas, corporations do. And corporations that got burned by the North Carolina transgender bathroom ban are exercising their muscle in Texas. And this could be a case where business leaders are actually able to promote progressive policies where the political system is failing. So, according to a Republican chair of the House State Affairs Committee, Byron Cook, corporate America is stepping forward, speaking loudly about the fact that this will have a chilling effect on business opportunities in this state. I'm hearing from many more major corporations about this bill and the effect it will have. Well, whatever it takes, I hope that that bill is defeated. And also, Trump, in some of his comments, defended his tweet about banning trannies from the military. And I'll note that there has been no published follow-up on that. There's no directive from the White House. The Pentagon has not taken any steps to make any changes in the treatment of transgender personnel. And so there is a lawsuit of 5 service members. I don't know how you sue against a tweet that has not been turned into any form of executive action. Sarah Palin has brought a lawsuit against the New York Times and is gaining some traction. This relates to an editorial that was published back in June on the same day that the gunman opened fire at the baseball field and seriously wounded Representative Steve Scalise and others. And the editorial that was published mentioned that Sarah Palin, during the 2008 campaign, was vilified for using images in campaign ads that related to guns. There were views through a sighting device, like a telescopic sight, and I believe there were images of targets that were used. This was all aired out after the shooting in Arizona that wounded Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. And it was published in the New York Times articles that said that there was no connection between Palin's advertising and the crime in Arizona. So the judge has ordered the editorial writer, James Bennett, from the New York Times to testify about whether or not he had read the New York Times articles about Sarah Palin and the use of those images. Looks like she's got the gray lady right there zeroed in on her telescopic sight. And finally today, I want to note that I am a fan of political theater. And I want to give 2 thumbs up to, what is his name, Brar, His first name is Taran Singh Brar, spelled B-R-A-R, an artist and documentary filmmaker who hails from Laredo, California. I don't even know where Laredo, California is, and I live here. Anyway, he is the guy who ordered up an inflatable chicken from China. It's Chinese made. And then he put a special edition on it, an orange mop on the head of the chicken, so that it instantly causes people to think of Donald Trump. So it took him 4 months to get permits from the National Park Service and to bring this to Washington, where he inflated it on Wednesday within view of the White House. He was actually off the White House property on what is called the Ellipse, but the White House and the Washington Monument were in the background. And Brar's message is that Trump is a chicken. He's a weak and ineffective leader. He's too afraid to release his tax returns, too afraid to stand up to Putin, and he's playing chicken with North Korea. We need more of this kind of expression. Can you get to work on something over the weekend and email it to me by Monday? Thanks for listening, and thanks for watching on Facebook, my daily news and comment podcast. It's available on YouTube. Check it out.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.